Demonology and the Triphasic Model of Trauma, an Integrative Approach. A Good Omens fanfic written by NNM and performed by Starcatcher Betty. Chapter 12, Oedipus and Electra. She could hear the echo from her shoes tapping against the floor as she walked through the hallway, and she didn't like it. She didn't like the echo, and she didn't like the hallway. "Please do make yourself at home," Aziraphale said. And no, Aubrey Time would not be making herself at home. She was trying to observe and assess as much as she could as she took in the look of the hallway. This was one of the benefits to in-home therapy, after all. A person's home could tell you so much about them, which you might otherwise not get to learn. There is an entire system of things and people and habits that could help you make sense of the diagnosable symptomology, all observable and accessible once you encounter the client in his own space. That was only one of the benefits to in-home therapy, and Aubrey Time wanted to take full advantage of it. She wanted to, but she found it difficult to focus on what she could see, given that she was so distracted by how it all felt. There are too many walls, she thought, and she didn't understand why. She didn't know why it felt that way to her. She didn't know entirely what it was she was trying to express about the space she was in when she thought that. She was certain she could count the walls, that she could count for the basic geometry of the space she was in, but she didn't feel like she could. There were too many walls, it felt like, and not anywhere near enough windows or doors. Maybe it was the echo. Maybe the echo was playing tricks on her mind. "May I offer you some tea?" Aziraphale asked, as helpful and kind and hopeful as always. "Thank you, but no," she said. "Perhaps coffee?" "No, thank you, really." She didn't want to accept anything. She didn't want to accept even a single pomegranate arrow while in this space. "Oh, root beer, then." "What?" "We don't have any, of course, but I do believe I could—"
"Tea, Aziraphale,"
came the exasperated yell from somewhere down the hallway.
"Tea's fine. Just bring some tea. It's fine."
So that was that, then. She watched as small hints of relief moved across Aziraphale's face, and she realized how cruel she had just been. He wanted to be a good host, even though this was not technically his apartment, his flat. He had needed an opportunity to act, to offer, to provide, and she had denied it. So Crowley, good old lovable Crowley, had intercepted. He could be a real asshole, arsehole, but he always made sure to take care of Aziraphale. "Just down that way," Aziraphale gestured, as if there were any need after Crowley's shout. "I'll be in with the tea." Aziraphale went off some other way, some other direction in the hallway, and left her to finish the journey by herself. The echoes from her shoes accompanied her to the doorway, and then she entered the room. This was something that they had spoken about at length. They had spoken about comfort levels, about safety, about boundaries. She had prompted him to consider what it would be like for him to have her in his space. She had herself attempted to consider what it would be like to be in his space. They had discussed at length what it would and wouldn't mean for her to step into his hallway, into his flat, into his living space, and even into his bedroom. This was the challenge and opportunity of in-house therapy. It required very clear ground rules. They had had plenty of time to talk through every angle of it. After his first phone call, she had gotten him to agree to 2 calls a day. She had insisted, 1 in the morning and 1 in the evening. He had pushed for her to accept the calls later in the day, given the time difference between them, but she had refused. He had said that the diurnal schedules of humans were irrelevant to him, but she didn't thoroughly believe it. And so, for the last few weeks, she had been waking up every morning at 4 a.m. in order to talk to him on the phone, and then she kept her schedule empty at 4 p.m. in order to talk to him on the phone again. They had talked. They had talked daily, twice daily, without seeing each other. He hadn't come into her office. He wouldn't. He had rejected every offer to set up an appointment. He would talk to her, but only on his terms, only if he could do so without coming back in person. He had told her, after all, that he wouldn't come back. He wouldn't come back unless she accepted his terms. Aziraphale had asked her if she did house calls, and she said no. He had asked a second time, and again she said no. The third time she was asked, the time that Crowley was the one who asked, she stopped lying and said yes. So they had planned. They had planned and they had prepared. If nothing else, it gave them something to talk about during their twice daily phone calls. They had needed something to talk about, given the unspoken understanding between them that it wasn't yet time, not yet, to broach the topic of the unsigned contract, about his unwillingness to come back, about the breach in their therapeutic alliance. They had needed something to talk about, because crisis intervention isn't the same as therapy. Not really. And he needed time to stabilize before they could get back to work. They had needed time. Now, they had a week. Or almost a week. She was flying home on the final day, so it didn't really count. They had a week minus a day. There was a lot for them to do, and a lot she hoped they would be able to do, within the span of a week, minus a day. She had thought perhaps she could manage it in just 5 days, but it was good to have a spare, to have extra time. The timeline of therapy could be unpredictable. They had a week, or more accurately, a week minus a day, and this was day one. She stepped into his room, and she gave herself a moment to observe and assess. The whole of this place felt strange and uncomfortable, and his bedroom was no different. The strangeness and discomfort, in fact, was even stronger in here. There was, first, the layout. She couldn't shake the thought, that incomprehensible and incoherent thought, that there were too many walls. There was no windows in here, either. It was a dark place. It was a lair. She was standing here, in a demonic lair. There was, second, the matter of lighting. It was dark in his lair, but it was not too dark. She could see, but she wasn't sure why. She noticed just one lamp, but it didn't seem to be giving off enough light to account for how well she could see. She thought, perhaps, if she focused too hard on the shadows and attempted to use them to find all of the sources of available light, she would end up with vertigo, or worse. It was best, she decided, to simply ignore it. There was, third, the matter of smell. There was a certain smell that Aubrey Time had come to expect when doing in-house therapy with clients like this. It was a musty, tangy smell. The smell of too much dried sweat and unwashed clothing. The smell of a human body after weeks of neglect. That smell wasn't present. It surprised her how much she could be unsettled by the lack of such an unpleasant smell. The room, instead, smelled fairly normal. It smelled like Crowley, yes, but it was not overpowering. So far as her olfactory sense was concerned, the room was entirely unremarkable, and that was what she noticed. There was, fourth, the matter of furniture. There was a bed in the room. She had expected the bed. She wasn't worried about that. With other clients, especially cisgender heterosexual male clients, in-house therapy in a room containing a bed was something to worry about. But this was Crowley, not someone else, and neither of them was concerned about the bed. There was also, in the room, a chair. It was a plain wooden chair, the kind of chair one would expect in an unassuming kitchen. It didn't belong, not in a place like this. It didn't belong, and it didn't belong in much the same way that Aziraphale looked like he didn't belong. It was clearly a chair that had been placed ahead of time, in preparation for her. What struck her as odd about the furniture was the lack of it beyond the bed and the chair. There was no closet, not that she could see. There was no dresser, at least not that she could see. There was, in fact, no place that she could see where clothing would be stored away. It was a strange lack. This wasn't a space that had been designed with practicalities like storage in mind. And there was, fifth and finally, the matter of her client. He wasn't in bed. She had expected him to be in bed. She knew, while he had been willing in recent days to get up and even leave his flat occasionally, he still wanted to spend most of his time in bed. But he wasn't there. He was, instead, curled up in a ball, deep in the farthest corner of the room, tucked up tight, right against the ceiling. "It's good to see you," she said, looking up. "Is it?" he said, turning his head to stare at her, and his tone told her all she needed to know. "I thought maybe your plan was to come all this way just to talk with Aziraphale." It told her where they were. It was where they had been since Aziraphale's visit to her office. This tone, and its meaning, had been a constant theme in her phone calls with Crowley. It was repetitive, this unrelenting bitterness. It was exhausting. She got the full brunt of the bitterness, she knew. Aziraphale got none of it. She was the one blamed for the forgery, not him. She was the one blamed for frightening Aziraphale, and Crowley wouldn't let her forget it. Crowley, she suspected, could hold a grudge longer than it would take for her bones to turn to ash if he really wanted to. They had a week minus a day to work past that bitterness. They had a week minus a day to get everything back on track. Somebody help her. They only had 6 days. She stepped farther into the room. She let her bag down onto the floor, and then she sat in the chair. She crossed one leg over the other, and she held her hands in her lap. She sat with his bitterness, with his silence, and she waited for the tea she did not want. It would have been easier if only there had been a clock on any of the walls. There wasn't. She should have brought a watch. The sound of Aziraphale making his way into the room cut through the silence, but not the displeasure that Crowley was radiating at her. Aziraphale made small little comments as he sat down a tray on the edge of the bed closest to her chair. The tray held a single cup of tea and a bowl of sugar. The tray held no saucer of milk, because of course Aziraphale would already know that she didn't drink milk. She could only wonder, in terror, how much he knew about her. She gave a smile, although she didn't exactly look at him. "Thank you," she said, and she tried to mean it. Aziraphale looked down at the tray, at the cuppa, at her, and it seemed as if he was working out some sort of painful logic puzzle. "Oh!" he exclaimed, apparently having solved the problem. "I almost forgot!" He hurried back out, leaving her again with silence and a very bitter demon. She decided she might as well count the seconds until he returned. 23 in total, it took. 23 seconds later, Aziraphale hurried back in. He hurried back in, he made his way back to the tray, and he set down a large glass that was filled to the brim with ice. She glanced up to Crowley. She glanced at him with an expression that said, "Why?" Crowley just glared. "There," Aziraphale said, and he sounded both pleased and relieved. "There, you must be all set now."
Yes, thank you," she said.
"All right, yes, yes."
Aziraphale was looking around the room, glancing up at Crowley, reaching out his hand now and then, as if certain there were something he could straighten or fix. But there wasn't. There wasn't anything for him to do. Not now.
"I'll be here in case anything should be needed. Do not hesitate to ask, Miss Time. Not at all."
"Thank you," she said again. What she needed was for him to just leave already.
"Well?"
Aziraphale glanced up again, up towards Crowley, and Aubrey Time could see the smile he gave to the bitter demon in the corner. She saw that smile. She saw just how much imploring hope it contained, and she felt relief it had not been aimed at her.
"I'll leave you to it, then."
Finally, he was gone. They had worked out a schedule ahead of time, over the phone. It was important to have a schedule and stick to it when doing intensive in-home therapy. The schedule was this. She would arrive at 9 a.m., 4 a.m. for her. It was 4 a.m. And she would stay until 11 a.m. Then she would take a 2-hour lunch. She would return at 1 p.m. and she would stay until 4 p.m. At that point, she would call it a day. They would call it a day when it was 11 a.m. in her home time, and she couldn't come back until 9 a.m. the next day. She had taken a red-eye flight to get here by 9 a.m. for the first day. She had taken a red-eye flight, and she had journeyed through the worst, deepest depths of Heathrow just so she could get to him. To sit here with him, and he wanted to pretend he hated her for it. That was fine. Let him pretend. That was, in her mind, what this day was all about. Day one, this day, was going to be all about denial. She stopped counting the seconds somewhere around 138. She lost count, and it didn't matter. She would wait as long as it took for Crowley to be willing to talk. "If you don't drink the tea," he finally said, "he's going to worry he did something wrong."
"It might as well be yours," she lied. "You're the one who asked for it."
"We don't have many visitors," he said. He shifted his posture. He uncoiled just slightly. "He's trying to be hospitable."
"I appreciate it," she said, and she worked so that it wasn't a lie. "I don't get the ice, though."
"You're American," he uncoiled a bit more. "You drink root beer, and you drink tea with ice in it. You heathen." Aubrey Time and Crowley, before everything went wrong, had an ongoing disagreement about Crowley's and Aziraphale's nationality. Crowley had insisted that they were not English, and they could not be English, that calling them English was just a product of her overactive, ridiculously human instinct to classify things she did not actually understand. She, for her part, had insisted that if it looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, and thinks, "so terribly sorry to hear it," is an appropriately heartfelt response to a friend's sobbing confession that he thought you had died, then what you've got is an English duck. They had agreed to disagree at the time. Now, it felt as though, in the last few minutes, she had scored a fairly significant point for her side in the debate. It would have been nice if she and Crowley could be on the sort of terms again that allowed that sort of debate to take place. If you stay up there all day, she said, still not touching the tea, then I'm going to get a crick in my neck. He was bitter, and he was petty, and he was as much of a son of a bitch as ever, but he was also, as always, generous and gentle. She had made clear a need, and so he would meet it. She watched as he uncoiled completely and then pulled himself across the ceiling. She had watched as he used his arms and legs to bring himself down the wall until he was at his headboard. And then he somehow changed his relationship to gravity so that he was lying down. It should have disrupted the tea tray, but it didn't. She wouldn't make jokes about The Exorcist. She felt like making jokes about The Exorcist. He wouldn't like those jokes, though, and so she wouldn't make them. He coiled up again. He coiled up, angled, so he could keep on glaring at her. He was satisfied with his ability to glare at her. "Let's talk about this," she said as a way to start. "What's it like having me in your personal space?" "Don't like it." "It feels like an intrusion," she said. "It is an intrusion," he said. "You invited me here." "It's not poison. Just drink the bloody tea."
She did not want to drink the bloody tea. "It really is good to see you," she tried to redirect. "It's been a long time."
"You're not dead yet, so it couldn't really have been that long, could it?"
She sighed. There were a variety of options available for her in way of response. She had thought through the variety of options available to her because she had prepared for him to be like this. She had thought through these options before she had arrived. She had thought through them, and she failed to sleep on her red-eye flight. She had thought through them as she was jumbled and corralled through Heathrow. She had thought through them as she checked into her hotel at 7 a.m., 2 a.m., and dropped off her luggage. She had put a lot of thought into them. She could say, "I understand why you are so angry." But they had gone down that road before. They had had that conversation again and again over the phone, and it had been completely unfruitful each time. She could say, "Aziraphale and I were worried about you," but they had gone down that road before too. He didn't accept it. She was the one who had frightened Aziraphale, not him. Never him. He held no responsibility for any of his shitty behavior, did he? She could say, "What would it take for you to trust me again?" But she knew the answer. He knew the answer. She had brought the unsigned contract in her luggage, because that was the reason that she was here, when she had a perfectly comfortable office in her own goddamned country. She had a lot of options. She had put a lot of thought into her options. And she had decided, she had realized, she had come to accept that what she would have to do is be open and honest. She had to be open and honest with him. "Fuck off," she said, and she meant it, because this was her being open and honest. "What I'm telling you is, I've missed you." She watched as his glare turned confused. "Take that, you son of a bitch," she thought. His glare turned confused, and then it softened. "Now," she said. She pulled the bag she had brought up from the floor onto her lap. "You've got a choice. Go fish, checkers, or tic-tac-toe."
"Ugh, ugh,"
he groaned out, as if she had just asked which pile of rotting garbage he'd like her to toss onto his bed. "Just choose one," she said. She had not asked, "Would you like to play a game?" A yes or no question like that would have made it too easy for him to say no. And here, in this encounter, she was going to insist on them playing a game.
She knew it would be easier to insist if he had not been given the option of resisting first. She put the expectation out there so it would be harder for him to resist. She also had not asked him to choose from only two options. Being presented with two options can feel like being given two extremes, and it can be hard to choose between extremes. Three options, on the other hand, comes with a middle, and the middle almost always feels safest. Most of the time, people will choose the middle option out of three. Aubrey Time wanted him to choose the middle option.
"Did you really bring a deck of cards in here?" he asked.
"Yep, and a checkerboard and some other things."
"Listen," he said, and he leaned his head a little closer to her, and he lowered his voice just enough. "Do not let Aziraphale know that there is a deck of cards in here." Hush, she thought. All of a sudden, he was willing to behave like a co-conspirator with her. She wondered why, but she also knew better than to take the bait. One primary challenge of in-home therapy is the risk of triangulation between different family members. It was easy to become enmeshed in others' disputes when engaging in in-home therapy, and it was virtually important that she not allow this to happen at all. "Just choose," she said. "Go fish, checkers, or tic-tac-toe."
"It's not called checkers over here," he breathed out, annoyed but resigned.
"No? Huh. Nothing could be easy, could it?" She pulled the checkers board out of her bag, as if he had agreed to play. She pushed the tea tray slightly to the side so she could start setting up the board.
"Are the rules the same?"
"Doesn't matter," he said.
He pushed himself into a more upright position, drawing himself closer to the board.
"I'm just going to cheat."
"That's fine," she started laying out the pieces. "Just try not to make it so obvious that I can tell." This wasn't about the game. It didn't matter who won or lost, and it didn't matter if he cheated. What mattered was that it could be a joint activity between them. What mattered was that it forced him to sit a bit more upright. What mattered was that moving the pieces involved some physical movement and concentration, but not too much. What mattered was that if he didn't cheat too obviously, then that meant, at the very least, he would have to stay attentive to the sort of goal-oriented activity involving in following the rules of a game. "Want red or black?" she asked.
"Don't care."
"Choose." The color didn't matter. The act of making choices, however, did.
"Red?"
"Okay, you go first. Help me get all the pieces set up."
Crowley, as much of a son of a bitch that they both knew he was also generous and gentle, and he liked having the chance to be helpful.
"Is this really what you're billing me for?"
he said that afternoon after they had played a mind-numbing amount of checkers, after she had gone to lunch and then returned, after she had started setting the checkerboard back up. When she had returned, the tray was gone. Aziraphale didn't seem upset, so she assumed Crowley had done something with the untouched tea. She would try and be more polite tomorrow.
"A transatlantic flight, 7 nights in a hotel, and bills for 5 hours a day, and we're just going to play checkers?" he went on.
The cost of the trip had been a contentious topic for them, over their phone calls, as they had prepared. Crowley, she knew, did not actually have any financial concerns. He had at first arranged for her to fly first class, and she had balked. When she had gotten Aziraphale to set up the hotel reservation for her, and she had really balked when she saw just where they thought to put her up. She had made demands. Business class tickets, business class hotel, absolutely nothing nicer than that. He was needling her now about it, or at least he was trying to.
"Yep," she said.
She wouldn't be needled. She would, however, be open and honest.
She would try, at least, to be open and honest. "We're playing checkers because I want us to have some time to just be together before we get to the hard work."
"Uh-huh," he said. He sounded wary.
"And it's helping me assess just how depressed you still are. Open and honest."
"Oh?"
He tilted his head a bit.
"Mm-hmm."
She didn't go on. They had a game to play.
"So, is Dave filling in for you again?"
he asked after a few more rounds, after they were both so sick of checkers that even talking about Dave was a better option.
"He is, indeed," she said, and she nodded.
She leaned back a bit in her chair, the wooden chair, which could only stay reasonably comfortable for about an hour at most, and she decided that she was satisfied he had brought it up.
"Let's talk about Dave," she said.
"I told you," he said low and fast. "I'm sorry about that."
No, actually. No, he had never said that. What he had said previously, time and time again, had been, "It's not my fault." He had never, not until now, said the word sorry in relation to Dave. That was interesting, she thought. But it wasn't what she wanted to focus on, not right now.
"Not that," she said. "No, what I want to talk about is this. Why do you think I asked Dave to fill in for me?"
"Huh?"
His lips curled upwards, confused and annoyed by it. "Why Dave?"
"Why not Dave?"
She shrugged. "You know how many other therapists there are in Rochester?" "Plenty. I could have chosen any of them. So why do you think I chose Dave out of all of them?"
"Because..."
He didn't have the words for it. He was confused. It was as if she had asked him, "Why is water wet?"
"He's your Dave. Who else would you ask?"
"Uh-huh," she said, and she nodded. She waited a moment, biting at her lip, looking down at the half-finished game of checkers between them. "So what does that mean, to say he's my Dave?"
"I should hope you'd know that,"
he snarked. Pulling teeth, she thought. She would change tacks. "Let's try a basic analogy." She could tell she was getting a bit pushy, so she brought their attention back to the game. She took her turn. She couldn't remember whether it was supposed to be hers or his turn next, but it didn't really matter. "I am to Dave, as you are to..."
"Aziraphale,"
he said. He said it like, duh. "Oh, you sweet idiot," she thought, and she chuckled a little. Just slightly. Not too much. She chuckled the amount that felt honest for how she was feeling. "So, think about that. What makes you think Dave is my Aziraphale?" He didn't respond, so she prodded. "Your move." He still didn't respond, but he did take his turn. "Crowley, I barely know Dave. I've never interacted with him socially. I don't want to interact with him socially. He's a colleague, but he's not a friend, and I don't want him to be a friend. So, you know why I asked him to fill in for me?" She raised her eyebrows, looked at him, waited for him to be curious. She took her turn. "Because his office is right down the hall from mine." "That's it. He's convenient. That's why." Crowley was thinking. She could see it in his eyes, the way they moved, this way and that. "Kind of a mystery, isn't it?" she said, not mystified by it at all, falling back into old habits, failing in the moment to be wholly open and honest. "You made some pretty major assumptions about me and Dave just because I gave you his business card. Your move." He moved a piece. It wasn't really a move in checkers. It was just him moving a piece.
If he kept that up for another turn or two, she might switch them to go fish. Whatever the deal with Aziraphale and playing cards may be. This is how therapy works, she went on, remembering herself again, working again towards being open and honest. It's how the therapeutic relationships work. You have Aziraphale, so you assume I have an Aziraphale too. You only hear me mention a single name, Dave's, and you assume he must be my Aziraphale. You take your stuff, she reached out with a hand, gesturing to the whole of him, and you see me through the lens of it. She brought her hand back, gesturing now as if placing an invisible hat on her head. She took her turn. This is why boundaries are so important for the type of work we're doing, she said, while sitting in his bedroom. You're my client, Crowley, and this is how a client connects to his therapist. He was looking down. He was thoughtful. They only had 5.5 days left. You're not a cipher, he said. He picked up a checker's piece, as if to take a move, but he just held it in his hand. He was looking down at the board. I know you, Aubrey. He called her Aubrey. She hadn't been Herb, not once, not since Aziraphale had come into her office. She felt weighted down by a sadness. You do, and I wouldn't have it any other way, she said. There was a vulnerability that came with being open. There was weakness that came with honesty. I'm not saying you don't know me. You just know me through a certain lens. Same as we all only know anyone through some certain lens or another. She thought she could see it. She thought he wanted to say, No, I know Aziraphale, not through a lens, but through all of them. He stopped himself, though. He put a piece he had been holding back down. He hadn't cheated. He put it right where it had been when he picked it up. They couldn't just pretend to play checkers all day. I think we have to start talking about the hard things, she said. He sighed. He pushed the checkers board off to the side. He kept looking down at it. Let me ask you this. Am I the first human you've ever known who's been at risk of being damned? She asked. She asked it like she knew the answer. She asked it in a way because they both knew the answer. Don't be stupid, he said. There have been more of them than either of us could possibly count, huh? More than you could, at least. So here's the question. She put one foot up on the edge of the bed so she could lean the chair on it, its back two legs. She folded her arms in front of her. Is it always this terrible for you when you come across a human who's at risk of damnation? That question wasn't entirely open and honest. She was working at it. She was working their way up to it. She wanted to be open and honest. She did, but she knew it would take time. She waited for him to put the puzzle together, to connect this to Dave, to understand her meaning. You take your stuff, she repeated, and you see me through the lens of it. So what you're saying is, he sounded annoyed. The reason I'm angry with you is because I'm actually angry with myself. Well, she stopped herself. She was about to say, does that sound right to you? But that wasn't what she was here to do. She was here, instead, to be open and honest. To try to be open and honest. That's not exactly what I meant. I mean, you're probably right. We should probably talk about whether you're angry with yourself. But what I was thinking about, actually, was why it's so painful and terrifying for you to think about me being damned. She watched him. He was quiet and thoughtful.
They were approaching the topic, this time, from a very intellectual position. It allowed distance, and thus safety, to intellectualize that which had the potential to hurt so much. She watched him. She watched as he lowered himself back to the horizontal position, curled himself back up into fetal position. No, not fetal position. He had never been a fetus. He was simply curled up, like something small, like something that knew how to protect its belly. She needed to be open and honest. This was what he needed, she thought. She hoped she was right. She hoped she had it right, and that what he needed was for her to be open and honest. "I made a really big mistake in working with you," she said, and she kept her arms folded in front of her, folded securely in front of her most vulnerable self. "I'm really sorry. You deserve better." She wanted those words to hang in the air. She wanted them there, in this space, his most private space. He deserved better. He deserved something, anything. He deserved better. There was still time until their working day was over. She sat, jet-lagged, in an uncomfortable wooden chair, and she wasted away the time by browsing the internet on her phone. She had nothing to do. Nothing to do except be. Be there. Be there with him. Be a breathing presence who could care and who could stay. Who could apologize for past mistakes. Who could offer an attempt to do better in the future. On the second day, she was confronted, again, with a tray and a cup of tea and a glass filled to the brim with ice. She said thank you, and she resolved again to take not one arrow, not one, not anything. It was a relief when Aziraphale declared that he would be leaving them to go to the bookshop today. Aziraphale, as well, looked relieved by it. She had to wonder how much he had managed in recent weeks to attend to his own self-care. She had to wonder how much he despised this flat, and how much it cost him, emotionally, to spend so much time within its echoing walls. She had to wonder how much time he had spent recently sitting in this same wooden chair, or some other uncomfortable space, tending to a bitter and sad demon. It was a relief when Aziraphale declared that he would be leaving. It was a relief because she had been really uncomfortable with the idea of him being around, given what she planned on discussing with her client today. She waited until he was gone, until they had both heard the front door close behind him. Then she reached into her bag, pulled out a folder, pulled out the unsigned contract, and placed that paper down on the corner of the bed. She placed it so that it was visible in the space between them. "I'll make a counteroffer," she said. She had his attention. He was sitting on the far side of the bed, with his knees up in front of him. His eyes looked out at her from within his self-made fortress of bony limbs. "I want you to listen to me," she said. "I want you to let me say everything I want to say, and I want you to listen to me. And then I'll make you my counteroffer." He regarded her. Then he nodded his head. "We're going to keep track of your distress level, too," she said. "I want you to listen. And I want you to also tell me if you're going anywhere above 30. I don't want to be talking at you when you're in too much pain to actually listen." She had his attention, a flick of his eyes. He accepted her terms. "Also, I want you to tell me right now, is there anything I can say that can cause you harm?" She was annoyed at herself because she didn't know how to form the question she meant to ask. "You know what I mean. Anything that..." She waved her arms. She didn't know what she was doing. "You know." He opened his mouth like he had intended to say something, but then changed his mind.
No,
he said simply.
Okay. Good.
She nodded her head. She gave herself a moment to shore herself up. She sucked at her teeth. She repositioned herself in her wooden chair, and she looked at him.
Are you ready to listen to me?
His eyes were on her, as they had been. He had made a flourish with his hand, which meant, go ahead. She took a deep breath, and she did what she could to make herself be open and honest in every way she found uncomfortable.
I like you, Anthony J. Crowley, she said.
She said it.
I like you, and I like getting to work with you. You're smart, and I like your sense of humor, and I like that you can be a complete son of a bitch.
She watched him. She watched him closely. He knew she was watching him, and he wasn't looking her in the eye. She wanted to be in her office, in her space, in her chair, with her clock on the wall and her rules, where she was the one who invited others in, where she got to be in control. She didn't want to be open and honest.
Distress level, she said.
10, he said.
10 meant she'd keep going.
You're resilient, and you're strong, and just let me say it, I think you're a good person. She waited to watch his reaction. His reaction was no reaction at all, not at first. Then he tilted himself over onto his side. He curled up again, his legs still in front of himself, shielding himself. His face was visible, but he wasn't looking at her.
Distress level.
20.
20 meant she'd keep going.
So, that's what I think. This was the hard part. This was the transition. She watched him, and then she kept going. And that's what I think about when I think about what happened to you. What she did to you. Just listen to me, please. You know what it makes me feel when I think about that? It makes me angry. It makes me angry for you. Anger is a mask for shame and fear and sorrow. But it is more than that, too. It can be important to feel anger. It is necessary to be capable of anger. This is because anger informs us about what we need, about what is right and just. Anger lets us be strong and stand up for the disadvantaged. Anger lets us revolt and fight and scream when anything else would be a capitulation to our own mistreatment. Anger matters. It can matter, and it can be vital, absolutely vital, for a trauma survivor to be capable of accessing their anger, of feeling it, of recognizing it for what it means. Now his eyes were on her. He was watching her. This is what I'm telling you, Crowley. I'm mad. I'm mad at her. I'm mad about what she's done, about what she did to you. She should have to beg forgiveness from you. You should get to decide whether she gets it or not. That's what I think.
Distress level.
He was watching her, his eyes straight on her. They weren't his angry eyes, not the eyes with all the anger she was so accustomed to having stare her down. They were bland eyes, not gazing and not vacant, but near to hollowed out. He wasn't breathing. She was fairly certain he wasn't breathing.
Crowley, distress level.
Keep going, he said.
Fine, she would.
This is why I'm not scared of being damned. She can't damn me, Crowley. She can't do that to me because I won't let her. My choice. I made it my choice. I reject
her. I reject what she has to offer. I reject it. I don't think she deserves my love. She watched him. He watched her. She felt certain, and she felt sure, and it felt good to say the words, to have them heard, to have them in the air, in the space between them. It felt good to be open and honest. It felt terrible, and it felt good. This wasn't about her, though. This wasn't about her month with Buddhist monks. This wasn't about her willingness to accept an afterlife or suffering. This was about him. She was being open and honest because she was his therapist, because she thought this could be what he needed. She watched him. She watched as he reached a hand back behind himself. She watched as that hand came back to his front, pulling with it a blanket that she was fairly certain hadn't been there before. She watched as he pulled the blanket around himself, around his limbs and his torso, around the whole of his head. He cocooned himself, and he coiled himself up into an even smaller shape there beneath his blanket. He hid himself completely, but he was still there. He was still there, simply below the surface. She couldn't stop now. She knew what Curly needed. At least, she thought she knew. She hoped she knew. She thought he needed her to be open and honest. "And," she said. "And." She said, "and." That was the word she said. She said, "and." Professional psychotherapists like Aubrey Time are trained to make use of a variety of micro-skills. These micro-skills could include reflective statements, summarizing statements, open questions, nonverbal emotional reflections, and so much more. These micro-skills are what allow a therapist to respond and react to her client precisely as she means to, precisely as she believes that she should, for his benefit. These micro-skills are what make a therapist a therapist. Far more than any theory, any technique, anything else. One of the hardest micro-skills for many psychotherapists to learn is to use the word "and." We don't often like this word. Not the word "and." We are comfortable in many ways. Far more with its mirror reflection. The word "but." We use that word, the word "but," to exclude experiences, to undermine the full totality of what we feel and need. We say, "I am scared, but I am strong." Or we say, "I am strong, but I am scared." It puts the two claims at odds, makes us choose between them, presents them as competitors for our attention. It shields us from having to acknowledge the truth, the whole truth of both claims, both together. I am scared, and I am strong. That is the power of the word "and." It doesn't exclude. It doesn't minimize or enforce competition between disparate feelings or needs. The word "and" is an expression of acceptance, of commitment to the whole truth. The word "and" can give one the power to be both open and honest. "And," she said again, "it's okay if you feel differently." The word "and" can be especially important for those who have suffered early life trauma at the hands of a parent. The word "and" can be especially important for those who are or have been abused children, children of abusive parents. The word "and" matters because the word "but" can cause so much pain. Children of abusive parents are hounded constantly by the word "but." They are told by half the world, "Sure, she's your mother, but she was so terrible to you." They are told by the other half, "Sure, she was so terrible to you, but she's still your mother." They are put in the middle, between the two truths, and they are made to choose between them. They are made to choose. Accept that she was your mother, or accept that she hurt you. But not both. Not both. You must choose a side in this war between nurturance and abuse. You must choose one or the other. You must choose. What so many children of abusive parents need, what they truly need, is simply the word and. They need to be allowed to feel both, to recognize the truth of both. They need to be told, it's okay if you still love the woman who hurt you. They need to be told, it's okay if you rage against the woman who fed you and held you. They need to be told, it's okay to feel both rage and love. What many children of abusive parents need, what so many of them truly need, is the freedom and compassion that comes from this word, that comes from the word, and. She loved you, and also she was broken and hateful. She screamed in your face, but also she sang you lullabies. She terrified you, and also she made you feel special. She was the only one who looked after you, and also she slapped you for asking for your supper. You attacked her, and also you were a child. You didn't mean to hurt her. You were only trying to protect yourself. You were only a child, a young child, a child who was terrified and hurt, and also you will feel guilty for the rest of your life for what you did. She packed up all her belongings in the middle of the night. And also, you loved her. You loved her. You couldn't help but love her. She abandoned you. She left you. She did the unforgivable. And also, you cried out to the empty air. You cried until bloody. You cried out and begged forgiveness for what you did. You cried that you would do anything. You would be good. You would try as hard as you could. If only she would come back. Come back. Please come back. Don't leave me all alone. I promise I'll be good. You're an adult. You're a professional. You're in control. And also, you will never stop being a broken and scared little child. That was the power of and. It was Aubrey Time's job. It was her responsibility, her honor, her single chance at anything like grace, to provide the space of the word and for her clients. Her clients like Crowley. It's okay, Crowley, she said. She said it softly. It was open and honest, and she was finally being open and honest. She was letting him see her for who she was, and she was open and honest enough to see him for who he was as well. As he stayed hidden and coiled up, safe beneath his blanket cocoon. It is completely okay, despite everything she's done to you. It's completely okay that you still love her. She let those words hang in the air between them. She let those words fill the whole room. She let them fill the room because she knew, she thought, she hoped that they were the honest truth that he needed to be allowed to hear. She and Crowley, they hadn't been on the same page. They would not be on the same page. Not about this. He wanted her forgiveness and love, and he would perhaps never have it. She could have her forgiveness and love, and she would perhaps never want it. They hadn't been on the same page, and perhaps they never would be. But they could sit together in compassionate honesty. They could see each other for who they really were. The blanket quaked and writhed. The blanket sobbed. It sobbed out. The blanket curled itself up as tight as it could, and it sobbed. Aubrey Time wiped at her eyes. She would sit here with Crowley. She would sit in compassionate honesty with him. She would sit with him for as long as he needed, as long as it took to make him feel safe enough to emerge from his cocoon.
"You're shit at theology," he said later.
Aziraphale was still gone, so she had pulled out the deck of cards. Crowley had vetoed Go Fish, which wasn't any real loss for her. They had settled on Gin Rummy.
"I don't have to know anything about theology," she said, taking her turn.
"I know you."